It's A Couple Cooks, the podcast with Sonia and Alex Overheiser. We're a couple on a mission to find the tastiest good-for-you eats you can make in your kitchen, because the way we eat can make a meaningful difference.
Join us as we chase after real good food through stories, recipes, and conversations about cooking at home and eating well. Welcome to the A Couple Cooks podcast. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're glad you're here. Today on the show, Sonia sits down with Ellen Bennett, who, like many of our guests, has gone to train in the culinary arts and work in a restaurant, but her path actually leads somewhere a little bit different, and it's quite the fascinating story, so stay tuned for that. If you listened to our last episode, we talked to pizza master Chris Bianco, and he was just talking so much about pizza that we decided we need to up our game a little bit. And we've been cooking, what, 3, 4, or 5 pizza nights in the last couple of weeks?
I don't know if we want to admit how many pizza nights we've had.
But that's the only way to get better at making your own pizza is to practice a lot. So sometimes you just have to kind of fight through it and put in the hard work.
But it has been pretty simple, I would say. We've been trying to keep it very minimal on the toppings. We've been doing things like pesto and tomato or prosciutto and mozzarella, or we found this really great mushroom truffle paste that we've been putting on with some hot peppers from our garden. So just keeping it really fresh and simple.
And we have a sweet little pizza oven in the backyard, so you're hardly making any dishes. And if you don't try to overdo it, like Chris said, less is more, then there's not so much prep either. So if you're looking for our pizza dough recipe, you can find one, our best one, in the upcoming cookbook, Pretty Simple Cooking, out in February, now available for pre-order. Find the link in our show notes. Little shameless plug there. And we also have our classic pizza dough recipes up on the website, and we'll share a link to those as well.
Along with a video, which is very helpful.
Oh, I forgot about that video.
That's right.
It's a good one.
All right, well, let's get to today's interview, which hopefully will not leave you hungry for food, but hungry instead for some fashionable duds for the kitchen. Our interview today is with Ellen Bennett of the company Headley & Bennett. In just 5 years, she has grown her company into a multi-million dollar kitchenware empire. Her aprons suit up fans like Mario Batali and Martha Stewart. She sells to 6,000 restaurants and to everyday people like you and me. Her success story is inspirational to hear, whether you just like a good success story or you want some takeaways for your own business. Here she is, Ellen Bennett. Ellen Bennett, welcome to the A Couple Cooks podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we talked to a lot of people doing exciting things in food on the show, and a lot of times their journey to where they are today is a pretty winding path. And so I wanted to ask you about yours. When did your love of food start?
I was totally a chubby little fat kid when I was little. From a very young age, I loved food, and my mother's mother is Mexican, and my mother is Mexican. My father is English. So I grew up with a pretty eclectic combination of foods. Everything from shepherd's pie and like English tea, English breakfast, to tamales and, you know, picadillo in my Mexican grandma's house in Mexico. So it was kind of an awesome mishmash of different worlds at a really young age, which made me love it even more, because I was like, holy cow, it's not just hamburgers and french fries. It's like the world has so many different foods, and I've been eating all of them since I was very little. So I think that's where the love really began.
That's a really eclectic mix. I love it.
Yeah.
Did you have like any fusion?
Instead of like baby food, I was, you know, drinking like bean broth. Like black bean broth is packed with fiber and all these amazing like vitamins and iron, and I would, you know, drink that when I was a little kid, and with a bunch of queso fresco, which is just like fresh cheese, which, you know, you would say now in fancy new age would be like organic, grass pasteurized, all that stuff, you know, cheese. And this is just what my grandmother grew up on, and so they gave it to me when I was a little kid. So I was just this like fat, hefty little kid that just had so much energy because they were just feeding me all this natural, delicious, amazing food and with no sugar.
And when did you start cooking alongside your parents?
I think it was about like 6 or 7 when okay. I started sitting on the table and being like, show me how you do that tamale thing. I want to try it. I want to be involved. I want to make the tortillas by hand. I want to help you with that. And I've always been very, like my mom used to tell me that when I was like 3 years old, I was helping her fold clothes and just, I was always involved with all that sort of stuff in the house and I loved it. And so they just kind of let me run free.
And that cooking as a child kind of developed into later in life, a love for cooking. And then that led you to cooking school.
Yeah. So about, by the time I was like 14 years old, I said, holy cow, I love doing this. I want to do this. I want to be a professional chef. This is what I want to do. And my parents got divorced when I was about 9. So by the time I was like 13, 14, I was cooking a lot of meals for my mom, who's a nurse and worked 12-hour shifts, right? So you can imagine she'd get home late, leave early. And I saw this opportunity to help her by feeding her. And not having her come home late and her not have any food and she'd have to make something and whatever. And I thought, well, I'm here just lounging around watching like Laura Ingalls Wilder, A Little House on the Prairie all day. If I could do something with my life. So I started Googling back in the old day, like AOL dial-up. I started Googling, you know, recipes from All Recipes. And she'd come home and I'd have like a dozen, like actually it wasn't a dozen. It was like 6 dozen bagels because I didn't read the proportions on the recipe, but I was committed, so I made the whole recipe. She'd just come home to such a like melting pot of different foods that I would make her, but she'd never say this, that was not good, or you know, that's not right. She would just embrace it and be like, oh, thank you, that's very nice, you know, little Mexican lady. And so I just grew up thinking like, holy cow, I can do anything I want in the world and I can make anything I want in the world because of her.
How sweet. As a teenager, like most teens are going out with their friends at that time, probably to the mall, right? And you're cooking for your mom.
Yeah, definitely wasn't going out to the mall when I was 14. Nope.
All right. So you developed some cooking skills when you're in your teens for your mom. And then you kind of knew at that time, which I feel like it's pretty early for a kid to know what they want to do. And then how did you then proceed to cooking school?
So I will say, I'll back up a little bit. When I was about 9 and a half, 10, and when my parents did get divorced, I sort of thought, holy cow, I'm on my own. I got to figure this out. Like, what am I going to do? I need to be successful at life. However that's going to be, I'm going to make it happen. And, you know, I think different people have that happen at different moments in their life. I just happened to have it at an early time, and it was very much just like an internal decision that I would be this independent woman and succeed and not, you know, be in a situation where I might be getting a divorce and not know what to do with my life and whatever. And so I just was like very heartfelt, and from that moment forward I looked at life a little bit differently. So every decision I made was with this attitude of I'm on my own, not in a negative way, but like I'm on my own. It's up to me. I'm in the driver's seat of my life. Where am I going to take it? And so when I was 14 and decided I'm going to take it in the chef route, when I turned 18, I decided to move to Mexico, Mexico City, and I went to culinary school in Mexico City. So that's how the whole thing sort of began. And I went to Mexico City because, for one, I love it. I'm also Mexican. And also, school was a little bit less expensive there. And there was something about LA that I didn't love growing up. It was very materialistic and everybody wanted to be an actor, a model. And I wasn't any of that. And because I wasn't that, I kind of felt like maybe there's something wrong with me because I'm not like everyone else. And having moved to Mexico and embracing like my heritage and the culture that I love, which is a very inclusive, warm, friendly culture, made me feel so like, no, there's nothing wrong with you, Ellen. That's just not your culture. Like, this is your culture. These are your people. Like, this is awesome. And so I proceeded to live there for 4 years, went to culinary school, like found my sea legs in life and just like learned how to hustle in Mexico, like work hard.
Is culinary school different in Mexico? Do you learn more Mexican-inspired or authentic Mexican cuisine than you would in another cooking school in the States?
Yeah, totally. It definitely has a bit more of a... It actually has a little bit more of an international spin. Like, it's not American cuisine as much as it is Mexican and then, like, European, a lot of it. But I actually made a deal with my dad, and I said, if you pay for my culinary school, pay for the restaurant management portion of school, and I'll learn how to cook professionally in a real restaurant. And then it'll just sort of balance out. So we struck a deal, and that's the way I did it. So I actually learned how to cook for real, in real restaurants. I didn't actually learn very much in culinary school, which is interesting because now that I've had experience in professional restaurants, I mean, in professional kitchens, I totally feel like that's the route to take. If you really, really want to be a chef, you should totally just go work at the best restaurant that you can get your hands on and work your way to the top and learn from the ground up every single station in a restaurant. And that's where you truly learn what it takes to be a chef.
So like hands-on learning.
Yeah,
to the max.
I mean, if you're working in a really excellent restaurant, you're going to learn everything that there is to know about anything. From amazing people, but with not so much theory, a lot more practical, you know, learning experiences. And for me, I'm a very, I watch and I learn by observation much more than I do by reading. So it was the perfect way for me to be able to learn how to cook, you know, like a boss.
So when you're in Mexico City, you kind of found this part of your identity. And did the things that you were eating, the people you were meeting, what you were learning in culinary school, how did that affect your home cooking for yourself?
Well, it definitely gave me a much more, I would say, a well-rounded approach. I wasn't just eating macaroni and cheese, you know, as a youth or even in my 20s. It was very much like enchiladas and mole and using spices and salsa for so many different things. And it's just like it's a layer of a little extra something, something. But at the same time, I had that old school shepherd's pie English cooking that I also love. So it's a funny combo. And if, you know, you ever meet me in person, like, I'm a very much the two cultures jammed into one person. So I have this English side that's sort of like dignified and proper. And then I have my sort of kooky, crazy, or colorful side, which is my Mexican side, and our brand, Hedley & Bennett, is very much like that as well. So it's a mix of the two everywhere I go.
A little bit of split personality going on.
Yeah, but in a way that they, like, work together. They're not, like, two different people. It's just one person that happens to have some worldly experiences in Mexico and England.
There you go. So you mentioned your brand, Hedley & Bennett. So take me from culinary school. You graduate. You're still in Mexico City. Then how do we get to Hedley & Bennett today?
So I moved back from Mexico. I sold everything. I had built a little life for myself there. I sold it all.
Did you consider staying there?
There was a time and a place where I did consider it. But after I graduated school, I was like, I can stay here, and I had really, you know, sown my roots there. And I was 22 and a half, and I thought, well, this can't be it. It can't be the end of it all. Like, I'm making lots of money. I have a house. I have a boyfriend. It's, like, all ready to go, and it's all, you know, pinned up. And I kind of just thought you did something here. You spent all this time working for this, you know, career in culinary world. Home and make something out of it. And so that's when I decided to leave Mexico, come back to LA, and essentially start from the ground up all over again, because it was quite established, as I said, in Mexico. But now I was going back to LA with nothing and going back to live with my mother, which was crazy considering I had been living on my own and I was just this, like, cool girl that moved to Mexico. And let me just remind you, I was not a cool girl when I arrived to Mexico. This, like, little lost turtle in the sea. And so I returned to LA, and a friend of mine gave me a giant list of restaurants and said, these are the places where you should get a job. If you really want to learn from the best, these are the spots. So I just hit up those restaurants one day with my resume and just marched into every kitchen and was like, where's the chef? I want to talk to him. And pitched myself on the spot to these different restaurants. And two of those restaurants gave me a shot. And one was Baco Mercat, or actually Lazy Ox, which is their other restaurant, with Joseph Centeno, who's an incredible chef. And then the other restaurant was Providence. And I got a job from both of them, and I took both jobs. So I worked half the week at one and half the week at the other. And that was so awesome from a learning experience, because one restaurant was a 2-Michelin-star one, and the other one was way more casual. And so on one hand, I was learning detail and, you know, consistency. And on the other restaurant, I was learning how to work the grill and do, you know, 350 tickets in one night. And in the other one, it was like 100 tickets, but of absolute pristine delivery and execution. So it was cool to learn both at once.
Wow, that sounds like a lot to manage.
Yeah, it was. It is. Like, I like to live life very aggressively.
That's what I'm learning.
Yeah.
All right, so you're working in these restaurants, and then at some point you decide to make aprons.
Yeah. So about a year, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. That's the story I was telling you. So about a year and a half into those jobs, I had been realizing that our uniforms were really terrible and they didn't make anybody particularly feel or look good at all. And I thought, geez, like, I'm an athlete as well. So I have an amazing outfit. I go run, I go do marathons. And it all started because I went and got a great Nike outfit. And I was like, hot damn, I could do this. Like, I am legit. And it was this decision, kind of like when I was a little kid and I decided that I was going to be successful when I was an adult or whatever. I just made this decision internally that I was going to change the way that people felt and looked in a kitchen. And I wanted to do it for myself, and I wanted to do it for them, and I wanted to do it for my team around me. And that was what started it. So, after I decided that in my head, a few weeks later, one of my chefs was like, hey, there's a girl. She's going to make some aprons. Do you want to buy one? You know, he was offering me to get in on an order. And I was like, sure, I have an apron company. I'll do your aprons. And I didn't have an apron company. I didn't have anything. I didn't even have a sewer. I had literally just the idea. But I love design, and I loved this concept of making people feel better and making them think that no matter who they were, they could be somebody. And so that's what started Headley and Bennett.
Wow. So you had nothing to show for it.
No,
and you were
nothing.
ready to start the business.
Nothing in capital letters. Yeah.
And now today you sell your aprons to 4,000 or so restaurants.
Now it's more. It's about 6,000.
6,000.
William Sonoma, Sir La Table, Whole Foods. We distribute them worldwide. We outfit all kinds of awesome people like Mario Batali and David Chang, and most of the shows on the Food Network wear Headley and Bennett. And anywhere you're on watching television or on Instagram, whatever, it's the apron that has a little ampersand on it. So it's a little square. Sometimes it's red, sometimes it's not, but it was inspired by the Lacoste alligator. So that's our logo, and that's a way for you to, you know, if you're out in the world and you're looking at someone, they're like, oh, that's an amazing apron. You know, it might have our little ampersand on there, and that means it's Headley and Bennett.
What I think is amazing about your story, well, there are many amazing factors, but one of them is that you've just been doing this 5 years. Now you're CEO of a multi-million dollar company. You have 30 some employees, if that's the right number. And
yes, that's right.
Okay. And that is incredibly fast growth for a business. So what do you feel like is the key, I guess, to your success? I'm sure lots of people ask you that, because it's not the normal story. It's very quick. How would you say that you got to where you are so quickly?
Right. I would definitely say that everybody's experiences are different. You can never compare yourself to someone else. So what might look like to you quick success, to me, if I compare myself to you know, somebody else, I might be like, my success is so slow compared to that person. So something that I always did was just stay on track with what I was doing. And I really stuck to my lane. And I said, I'm going to make the best aprons and workwear in the world. And it's going to be the best on every level. And I was just like a rabid animal about that. I just stuck to it and have been sticking to it every day since. And not letting down. I think sometimes when people start to feel successful, they sort of like take their foot off the brake, the gas. And in my case, we just are going more and more and working even more to get everything correct and right and organized and operationally, you know, sound and all the things that I didn't have in the beginning. But that was okay. That was how I did it. And so it's sort of like everyone has their own experience, so don't compare yourself. And everyone has to bring something magical to the table. So my magical sauce was that I wanted to make people feel amazing, but also provide an incredible uniform that made people look and feel great, but also make restaurants look amazing and make TV shows and chefs and cooks feel and look amazing. So that was my, you know, special sauce. And everyone has a special different thing. And I think embracing whatever it is that makes you different is where you can really succeed. Because if you're trying to be like everyone else, you're just going to be chasing someone else's like ideas and dreams and not your own. So you've got to just embrace them.
I love that saying, in your own lane, keeping the blinders on is kind of what I like to say too.
Totally. Keeping your blinders on and being humble enough to realize that you can't do it all on your own and that you don't need to have every single answer to everything. I have an unbelievable team that's so freaking supportive and awesome. But when I don't have an answer to how to run this company, I get more resources and I get more people to bring their expertise to the table. And I'm the first to say, you know what? We don't actually know how to do this. How do you do that? What do you do? What's your idea? What's your thought? And in just collaborating on knowledge to grow our company has been incredibly helpful for us. And, you know, I just turned 30. So when I started this, I was 25. I'm 30 now. There's so many things I just didn't know. And if you're willing to learn, I think you can get a lot further, a lot quicker than just acting like you know or having an ego attached to what you're doing.
That's so important to have that collaboration. And what I like about your business is that you're focused on, making money, making aprons, but you're also focused on others and doing good in the world. And I think I've seen a lot of businesses doing that these days. There are social enterprise businesses and other businesses that just have a greater purpose than just the bottom line.
Oh, 100%. And I think that's actually really important. Now, you can't just like operate. It's terrible, but I always throw AT&T under the bus because their customers are just the pits. But I think of businesses like AT&T for the longest time were just these giant monopolies that nobody had a choice but to work with them, right? And now the world is shifting where you actually have a choice on where you're going to put your resources and your hard-earned money. So companies have this like new expectation almost to show people like, hey, we are actually human beings running this company, and not even expectations. I think it's like a responsibility. Like I look at it as not a burden, but I look at it as like an awesome opportunity to use my business for good and not just to make money, because making money is great. But like if it's hollow, it's sort of, it's just nasty. It's not good. You like might as well go sell drugs, you know? Like I want to do something that makes a difference in the world. And if every business made a difference in the world, then holy crap, we would be in a much better place than we are today.
I like what you said about showing that you're human too. And I think you're someone who I would say is exemplary in that fact. You're pretty active on social media. You get to see all the fun you're having every day. You have a treehouse in your facility and a slide.
We have a big, about 17,000 square feet factory in downtown, and anybody can come in for a tour and they are greeted with ice cream and a hug, and they get to walk around and see how our manufacturing process works and also our entire team. And we have, you know, a giant fake grass patch with picnic tables in the middle of it, and there's a showroom, and there's a coffee bar connected to some of our tree houses, which is where my office is, and there's a zip line that comes out of it. So it's quite like Willy Wonka. You know, it's a very unusual approach to business. But at the on the flip side, we also take what we're doing incredibly seriously, and we work with some pretty heavy hitters, so we can't just be like, oh yeah, sorry Four Seasons, SpaceX, and Delta Airlines. Like, we messed up on that. We also stand true to our quality and what we're doing. Like, it's a real business, but we have some real values and we have real people running it. So it's meaningful.
I can hear some people maybe thinking, oh, that just sounds so fun and magical and it's all fun all the time. I'm sure that it's pretty darn stressful being the CEO of a company. How would you describe your day-to-day fun versus stress?
It's definitely super intense and absolutely crazy. And as the company grows more and more, I've had to go from just like Ellen having an amazing time doing this to Ellen has a real responsibility with real people's livelihoods, you know, at her fingertips. And I need to make sure that I do the best, that I be the best person that I can be to them as a CEO. And a CEO is very different from, like, you know, the Ellen that you see jumping around on stage somewhere. Like, when I'm the CEO, it's like, I don't know. I can't describe it better than just like my big kid pants are on, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, this is a P&L. That's workers' comp. We need to, you know, look at this. What's our EBITDA like this month? Let's focus on that. Our sales projections, those are down. What's happening in marketing? We need to follow through on that. What's the ROI? Like, it just turns into this almost other person that I've learned to become because I had to. And it also is super interesting and incredible. It's kind of like when you're, you know, like, what are those guys that are making music? They sit there and they're like the sound guys and they're moving all these little like levers. That's kind of like a technician, like a musical technician. It's kind of like what it feels like to run a company. You're like, let me tweak this over here and see what happens. I'm going to adjust this and lower that and make more of this and put more funds into this department and see what happens and then watch it grow and then fix that when it doesn't work. And that it's awesome. I love it. And it's also totally insane. And it's not for everyone. That's another thing I've realized. Like, there's a lot of roles within my becoming a real CEO that I've recognized. I don't necessarily do that job great. I do this job over here better. Let's not have you working on, you know, this customer service area. Let's have you working on marketing. Like, you kind of have to build your company a little bit around what you're really good at and get amazing people to strengthen those areas that you're not so strong at. And that's totally fine.
Absolutely. Work in those strengths instead of the weaknesses, right?
And admitting that you have that weakness so that you can make it better, right? Like, I used to kind of want to be the hero of everything. I used to take on so many responsibilities, your head would explode if I just listed them out to you. And now I've realized, like, that doesn't do anybody any good, including myself. And I need to turn to my team to get the support that I need from them and not just be like, I don't know how else to say it, but like blocking them on taking ownership on something. And that's part of growing up as a CEO, I think.
Tell me a little bit about your school of hustle. I know it just happened.
Yeah. So a lot of, we even have a department within our company here. Seems funny since not every clothing company has a department focused on events, but we have a special project and events department, and that's where we activate our community. And so I've always approached Hedley and Bennett from in real life, but also social online. So the Instagram School of Hustle event was this thing that we planned together with our friends over at Instagram. And it was a full day conference created by us to be able to impart all the knowledge that we've learned over the last 5 years on how to run a business, how to start a business, like how to make your dream basically come true in a really tangible, real fashion. And I thought, well, who better than to partner with Instagram to do that, right? And it was so cool. We had people apply from all over the United States, and we limited it to 200 people. There was a whole vetting process. And then those 200 people got to come in for an all-day conference at the factory that was completely free to them. And this was how we celebrated our 5-year anniversary as a company. So, you know, you can throw a party and everyone comes and like has fun and dances and they walk away with nothing except a good time. I thought, what if we could have them walk away with knowledge and then forward their own dreams and goals? And that's what we did with that event. And it was like, one of those bucket lists, check it off the bucket list items. It was awesome.
That's incredible. I love the way that you kind of flipped what would be normal is just having a party, but you think of it in a whole different way. And yeah, maybe that's part of your success as a businesswoman of being able to look at something and say, you know, everyone's done it this way forever, but what if we did it that way?
Yep, totally. Or if you don't see the walls, you sort of walk right through them. I think I don't have an MBA, but I'm kind of glad that I don't, because we figured out what works from MBA land and have added our own magic to the mix.
All right. So a lot of our listeners are home cooks, and I'm wondering, what do you like to cook at home and how does your Mexican heritage play into that?
Truth is, I'm such a workaholic, as you can see on my at Ellen Marie Bennett Instagram. We recently separated my account from Hedley and Bennett's account, but it's great because you get to see like my real life. But a lot of times I'm at the Apron HQ in my treehouse till like 10 o'clock at night working on something. So I end up just scrounging random stuff from our kitchen. But we also have these garden towers at our office that grow basil and lettuce and all kinds of really delicious veggies. So I might go out there and like take a butter lettuce head and eat that for dinner. But for the most part, I eat pretty simply. There's a lot of events that I attend that end up being very heavy in food and greasy and just like 10 course meals and foie gras. So when I'm at the factory or at home, I like to eat really simply and clean and just like, you know, eggs over wild rice and, you know, sauteed broccolini and just like simple, delicious food.
If you were to have an afternoon to cook something, what recipe would you choose?
I'm such a sucker for spaghetti and meatballs. So I would say spaghetti and meatballs.
Classic.
Oh, it's just so good.
So nothing Mexican then?
No, I think let's be real. I would totally make tacos any night of the week. So yes, tacos. That's true. I do love black beans and cheese. Back to my little kid growing up eating, you know, whole bowls of fresh queso fresco with beans and tortillas from the corner store. Like, I love that. I actually really profoundly enjoy a bowl of black beans, like more than the average human being. So I like that. But I'd say tacos. I love making like anything Italian is so delicious to me, like lasagna and spaghetti and, you know, all things pasta related. Again, little fat kid, just remember.
Speaking of kids, my husband Alex and I just adopted a boy named Larson. He's 6 months and he has a little bit of Mexican heritage. And
congratulations.
Oh, thank you. And so I've been kind of searching for some authentic Mexican recipes. Alex and I eat a lot of Mexican food, and we had one person, a blogger, contribute a recipe for sopes, which are so amazing. Good. Yeah. Did you grow up eating sopes?
Yes, 100%. Oh, I will totally contribute a Mexican recipe to your blog. I'd be happy.
Oh, that's yes.
And you know, we also make little kid aprons too now.
Uh-oh. I'm pretty sure I see that in my future.
And that we have like mommy and me, dad and I set that are awesome. So they're literally a replica of our professional grade badass aprons, but for little bodies. And we outfit almost all the little kid shows on the Food Network too. So they all have the little Hedley and Bennett aprons.
Oh, okay. I'm going to head over there and check those out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, to wrap up, I'm going to ask you a question I like to ask some of our guests.
Yes, tell me.
I was asked it in an interview once, and I just love asking other people. If you had the opportunity to get a message across to a large group of people, what would your message be?
Well, I'd say twofold. There's a message painted on the side of our building, and it says, "The front door's closed, climbing through the window." And that's like kind of like my life motto. It's, you don't stop when someone says no. You don't stop when there's a bump in the ground. You just have to keep going through it. And it's it's tenacity and grit and perseverance that gets you through and to the other side of tough times and to your goal. Like, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And every amazing, incredible entrepreneur that you look up to has been through hell in a handbasket and back, and you just don't know it. So don't ever think that it's harder for you or easier for you than other people. Everyone has a crazy journey that they're on, and you just got to find something that you really, you're like, okay, this is worth fighting for, and I'm going to stick to that. And for me, it was aprons. You know, find your apron, basically. Find that thing that makes you wake up and fight in the morning, and that will help you get through to achieving those goals. And believe it or not, the sad thing about it is that once you achieve those goals, you're going to want other goals, and then you're going to keep going. So it's just this, like, endless fight to get to your goals. But that's also the thrill of life. So it's all good.
You said twofold. Was that two?
Oh, that was one.
Oh, okay.
And my other one. So my other one is wake up and fight. And that just means, like, every day that we're alive, we have this opportunity where we're here and we're breathing and we have arms and legs and a, you know, a head that works. It's like, it, take advantage of that. It's a regular sort of thing that you just don't think about, but it's so powerful and meaningful that we're here. And just don't take it for granted. Life is beautiful. And, you know, I've met so many people along the way that at one time or another, maybe had something where life maybe was taken away from them, and they got to stick around and they cherish life. And, like, you don't need a death, near death experience to cherish life that way. You should just cherish life because life is beautiful.
I'm going to leave it right there. I love that.
Amazing. Well, thank you for having me. I'm very, very happy to have been here today.
Thank you so much for joining us.
I find it really interesting that the idea of buying a great Nike outfit might get you inspired to run a marathon, or a great apron might make you feel like a successful chef before you actually have the skills, or maybe a sports car makes you feel like a race car driver even when you're not. There's something to a high quality product that can really inspire you to do something that you wouldn't otherwise do.
But if I'm buying that Nike outfit, that apron, and that sports car, that might get a little crazy.
Especially with the more spend thrift among us. I agree. But I think maybe there's room in some of our budgets to just think about not necessarily a luxury item. We don't all need truffles on our simple pizza. But maybe there are some higher quality items out there that can really get us going in the kitchen. I'm thinking back when we were first married, we had some friends get married that same summer, and they bought a $300 cast iron Dutch oven. And I thought that they were crazy because we didn't cook at the time. And why in the world would you spend $300 on a Dutch oven?
And I remember your sister got a bunch of ramekins. I didn't even know what a ramekin was.
That's true. Not that ramekins are particularly expensive, but very true. We do not have quite the kitchenware expertise that we've grown over time. But when I think about that Dutch oven, I bet 10 years later, they're still using it on a regular basis. I remember how many soups they would make, how many stews. They would braise things. They would bake things. They would cook things. They would make soups. And that was an item that they used a lot that I'm sure has lasted the test of time and was maybe worth $300.
One of the best examples I can think of for myself is a kitchen knife. I remember thinking back again when we were first starting in the kitchen, we had some knives that weren't so sharp, and we decided after a few years of cooking that it was time to invest in a really good knife. So we went to a cooking store and tried out a bunch of fancy knives, and they were a little more expensive than we had spent in the past, but we still have those knives today. And every time I use it, I feel like a million bucks.
Yeah. And you feel like you can cook anything because you have a great knife.
I mince my garlic and I dice my onion. I can do it quickly and with precision. and I feel great doing it.
And when I think about, I think one of those knives was like $90, which seems crazy, but we're probably 7 years into that knife and still sharpening it regularly and using it. And so now we're down to $12 a year. That doesn't seem so bad for a great kitchenware item.
So I think the theme here is quality over quantity.
Right. And if you feel like a great apron that is durable, that is beautiful, will inspire you to make some more food, then maybe it's just worth that extra money.
And if you just want to outfit your kid in a really cute apron, that's fine too.
We won't judge you. So speaking of kitchen wares, I know that if I want to make great homemade Mexican food, I should probably be buying myself a tortilla press.
Well, not unless you want to make sopes.
Exactly. What are sopes?
So if you remember in the interview, Ellen and I talked about sopes, and they are Mexican street food. They're a little bit like a thicker tortilla, and the edges are actually crimped up. So instead of holding it in your hand, kind of in the wraparound style, it's actually a circular disc with raised edges. Almost looks like a small pie or tart, but it is savory. It's like a taco, so you can
fill taco
it.
Pie?
You could call it a taco pie. You can fill it with anything you would use for a taco. And in our recipe on our website, we filled them with refried black beans and then a little bit of crunchy romaine on the top, some bright pink pickled onions, which adds a beautiful visual element, and then some hot sauce. I think we made ours fully vegan or plant-based, and we used a cashew cream on the top. You could also use a sour cream. So they're actually not too difficult to make, pretty simple, in fact. And what you do is you make a very simple dough. You roll it into circles, press it down with a pie plate.
I think there's some pictures of that on the blog.
There are. So you don't need a tortilla press, just a pie plate. Flatten that down, put it on a very hot griddle, cook them just a few minutes, and then crimp up the edges. They're best eaten the day that they're made, so you can make all the fillings in advance, and then you can cook up your sopes. And I love them so much, I think that we need a special day for eating these sopes. So a follower suggested sopes Saturday could be a new trend.
Oh, not like hashtag sopes day, which would only be once a year, but you're saying right. Once a week.
Exactly. You like Taco Tuesday, Pizza Friday, sopes Saturday.
Let's I love it. Sábado, sábado, sábado. Sopes. You've convinced me that it's pretty simple to make these sopes, but can you tell me a little bit about the masa harina that's in there instead of cornmeal?
Right. Masa harina is the corn flour that's used in Mexican cooking. It's used to make tortillas if you've made your own. And it's a very fine corn flour. It's actually been soaked and cooked in an alkaline solution. And it's used for tortillas, tamales, pupusas, and sopes.
Great. And I think you can pretty much find it in any grocery store. Just check out that Mexican International section and you can probably find it nearby you.
Well, I can't wait to make more sopes, and I'm excited to hear what Ellen's Mexican recipe is that she wants to share with us. So we will get back with you once we get that recipe. And speaking of Ellen, if you'd like to check out her beautiful apron selection, you can head over to her website, headleyandbennett.com. You can also follow her on Instagram at Headley and Bennett, and I will also place her personal Instagram feed in our show notes. You can head over there for the links to all those fine places. Well, that's our show for today. As always, you can follow us over at acouplecooks.com or on Instagram at acouplecooks, Facebook and Twitter at acouplecooks.
At A Couple Cooks in all of the places. And you can always find the show notes at acouplecookspodcast.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, we would appreciate it if you would tell a friend or maybe your mom or maybe your spouse to go ahead and download it on their phone so that they can listen along to all the fun.
Talk to you next time.